Hello, everybody. Hope you had a good Labor Day weekend, politics soaked or politics free, as you preferred. Now let's make the transition from the Republican to the Democratic convention. If there is one question the Democrats will have to try to answer, it is this.
If you felt that excitement when you voted for Barack Obama, shouldn't you feel that way now that he's President Obama? You know there's something wrong with the kind of job he's done as president when the best feeling you had was the day you voted for him.
And the Democrats got off to a poor start over the weekend. Here is David Plouffe, a top Obama campaign person, being asked a version of the question by George Stephanopoulos on ABC This Week.
Can the president argue unequivocally that Americans are better off today than they were 4 years ago?
Listen, George, I think the American people understand that we got into a terrible economic situation, a recession the Great Depression is the only thing the country's ever seen like it. So they know we had a deep hole. It took us a long time to get into that hole. It's going to take us a long time to get out of it.
We'll talk in just a few minutes with the DNC chair, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and see how she describes the Obama presidency as a success. First, we begin week two with PBS NewsHour anchor Judy Woodruff. Hi, Judy. Thanks for giving us some time from Radio Row on what I know will be a long day for you. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Great to talk to you.
David Plouffe struggled with that answer Sunday on one network. Obama campaign manager David Axelrod on another. Isn't that the question they must have known was coming to hit out of the park?
Well, I think they miscalculated a bit. I think they thought that they could say no, but, and turn the corner. But they decided, that is not working. And now they've pivoted 180 degrees, and they are saying, absolutely, the country's better off. We don't want to go as a country back to where we were in 2008. And they're coming out full force. I just came from a briefing with some of the top strategists, in fact, the campaign manager, Jim Messina. And their answer now is, yes, the country's better off. Who wants to go back to where we were in 2008? In fact, who wants to go back to the economic policies of the 2000s that led to the financial collapse?
Here is President Obama campaigning over the weekend.
And when Governor Romney had his chance to let you in on his secret sauce, he didn't offer you a single new idea. It was just a retread of the same old policies that have been sticking it to the middle class for years.
Do you think they'll go hard after Romney and Ryan on policy specifics this week in that secret sauce?
I think that, Brian, that's going to be part of the pitch, but they also know what they're telling us, telling me and others, is that they also know they have to talk about what President Obama is going to do in a second term. They realize it's not enough just to go after Governor Romney. They've done a lot of their advertising over the last several months. They feel that's been very effective. The fact that Romney had to spend so much of his convention sort of introducing himself to the American people. But they recognize people are looking to President Obama now and asking, okay, you're asking for another chance. What are you going to do? And things have not gone as things have not gotten better as quickly as you probably thought and as the country wanted. So what's going to be different? And so he has to, you know, he's on the spot. He and the other people who are speaking. You'll hear from Michelle Obama, the first lady, on that. You certainly will hear an argument from Bill Clinton, former President Clinton, about that. And certainly you'll hear it from President Obama. But they know they have to make that part of their message this week.
Judy Woodruff from PBS with us from Charlotte. To debrief the Republican convention a little bit, Judy, the Wall Street Journal printed a very critical editorial on Romney's speech on Saturday. They weren't happy that he buried his economic agenda in a speech all about his personal life and attacking the president. He never mentioned his 20% across-the-board tax cut, for example. And William Kristol from Fox News and the Weekly Standard is among those kind of shocked that Romney never mentioned the war in Afghanistan or thanked the troops. So Romney did not make the policy folks on the right happy, either on domestic or foreign policy. How do you understand those omissions?
Well, I think that's very interesting, and I think it gets back to what you and I were just talking about a moment ago, that the Obama campaign spent a lot of money over June and July going after Romney's business record and his record as governor of Massachusetts, but particularly the record at Bain Capital and Romney's and what Romney has done with his own investments and the overseas investments, and questions about why he has not released his tax returns other than, I guess, a year or, and part of another year. And they feel that that is what caused or what has made it necessary for the Romney camp and the Republicans to, in essence, correct the picture or try to correct the picture at the Republican convention. So they feel, the Democrats feel, they succeeded in sort of changing the mission for the Romney campaign at the Republican convention, and therefore they didn't have time or they didn't have room. But I would say, in addition to that, Brian, it's also the case that when you talk to the Romney people, they don't want to get very specific about what they're going to do. In fact, one of them has said, I believe it was Eric Fernstrom, who's the campaign manager, said in so many words that they don't want to get too specific because they say the other side is just going to attack us for what we propose. Whatever the reason is, they made a calculated decision not to do that.
So Romney was boxed in by his low numbers on whether he cares about middle-class people and things like that. So that's some of the criticism from the right about what he left out among journalists and fact-checkers on the Sunday talk shows as I watched them. One of the topics was the litany of lies that the Republicans and especially Paul Ryan told in their speeches. Ryan, with his hometown auto plant that closed under Bush, and he implied it closed under Obama, his castigating Obama for opposing Simpson-Bowles deficit reduction when Ryan himself voted against it, and other things. Not that the Obama campaign hasn't had some whoppers of their own this year, but people are calling last week unprecedented in scale. And I'm curious, with your experience covering conventions, do you have your own observations about that?
Well, here's my take on it. I think if you're running a state and local race, if you're running for mayor, if you're running for Congress or the Senate, I think it's harder. I think it's easier to get away with some of the, exaggerations or distortions. But when you're running for president and there's so much media coverage of every word out of your mouth, it is very difficult. It's harder to get away with saying things that are just not based in reality. And every fact checker that's gone after what the Republicans are saying about the Ryan criticism of Obama on Medicare, on what happens with Medicare under the president's health care reform plan, not acknowledging that Ryan himself would take those Medicare cuts in his own budget proposal, what Ryan said in his speech about that General Motors plant closing down in his congressional district, and a number of other statements that they made, the welfare reform ad. The independent fact checkers, the folks who work for newspapers or who don't work for either campaign, are calling the Romney camp on that. You're absolutely right. The Obama camp has done its own share of exaggerations, but it really will be interesting to see if the Romney camp can get away with saying some of the things that they are continuing to say when fact checkers have continuously pointed out that the facts are otherwise.
How will you cover that on the NewsHour this week? Will you do anything like a comparative truth score after hearing the Democrats?
Well, we certainly are going to hold their feet to the fire. I mean, we talked about that during the Republican convention. We asked some of the folks we interviewed after the speeches at the Republican convention. We're going to be doing the very same thing at the Democratic convention. Both parties, I believe, have to be held accountable for what they say. I mean, voters deserve, that's the very least voters deserve.
Back to the Democrats. How much do you think this alleged racist Bill Clinton quip from 2008 reported in The New Yorker this week, where he may have said to Ted Kennedy in the 2008 cycle, this guy would have been carrying our bags about Obama a few years ago. It's not reported with a source or anything more than rumor, really, via the late Tim Russert. But, of course, it was the front page headline in The New York Post yesterday. Will it be a problem for the convention? Will it discredit whatever Clinton says in support of Obama in his primetime speech tomorrow night? Any way to gauge?
That quote was reported back in 2008. Everybody I know in the media was aware of it, and it was no doubt that and a whole lot else was the source of shall we say, tension, you know, some ill feelings between the Obama and the Clinton folks and between these two men themselves for a long period. It took a long time for them to sort of iron out their rough edges in their relationship. But everything we are given to believe is that since mid to late 2011, President Obama started actively trying to patch up his relationship with President Clinton. He reached out to President Clinton, and what we are told now is the two of them have a good working relationship. They're not close friends, but they are working together, and we are told that President Clinton is going to be very active in this fall campaign. He's supposed to be giving a full-throated endorsement of the president. The Obama campaign, when he speaks on Wednesday night, here in North Carolina around battleground states, President Clinton is featured in ads that the Obama campaign is running, saying that it is the Obama campaign the Obama economic decisions that have brought the country to the point that it is, that things would have been a whole lot worse off if the policies of the Republicans had continued. So everything we are told is at this point, at early September, is that Bill Clinton is fully on board despite any personal animosity. There clearly was, I mean, Clinton's wife ran against Barack Obama, so there's no, I mean, you know, it's no surprise that it was rough for a while, but everything we are told is that they've patched it up as much as they can professionally.
We have just a couple of minutes left with Judy Woodruff from PBS at the Democratic Convention. Are you paying attention to the Occupy Wall Street presence in Charlotte? They are apparently being more aggressive with the Democratic Convention than they were at the Republican one. Have you seen it yet?
You know, I've seen the news coverage, Brian, but they are kept far enough away from at least where the media is operating, or maybe I'm kept far enough away because they've got us in the lower basement of a big conference center. So I've been going from my hotel straight to the workspace every morning and then to the arena. So I have not yet had an opportunity to get around Charlotte and see the coverage or see the protesters. I know they're here. We had video of them. My colleague Ray Suarez was yesterday out talking to some of them. So I know they're here, and I'm listening to what they're saying, but I personally haven't been able to get out there.
Last question, then. From within the hall on that, I know people are still coming in for day one, but the Democrats' choice of Charlotte, known as Wall Street South, the convention being held in Bank of America Stadium. One tweet I received wanted to rename the facility 23.75 APR Stadium, ha, ha, ha. Not the most progressive optics in that.
Well, you know, people are looking at it from that perspective, and then other people are saying, why in the world do the Democrats hold the convention in the South when the South is such a reach for the Democrats? So, you know, they're all different perspectives. I mean, it depends on which pair of glasses you put on and which angle you want to look at this from. There's much to be made of it either way. I think in the last analysis, the president's campaign is trying to, say, put a stake here in North Carolina and say, we care about this state, we want to win the state of North Carolina, and they're trying like mad to do that, although, you know, they know it's an uphill climb. It's not nearly as easy as it was for them 4 years ago.
When they did win it. Judy Woodruff, thanks a lot.
Brian, thank you. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, the Democratic National Committee Chair, Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Stay tuned. Democratic National Committee Chair and Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz joins us. Thanks so much for doing this, Congresswoman. Welcome to our program.
You're welcome.
The Republicans laid out their case against President Obama at their convention. One central argument is that he promised to fix the economy, and it didn't work, and they can do better. So for people who are disappointed in the results of the last 4 years, can you defend that record as a success?
I can defend President Obama's record as a success. Remember, President Obama inherited the largest set of problems at once of any president since FDR. And the economy was hemorrhaging 750,000 jobs a month when he first took office. Thanks to his policies, thanks to, for example, the Recovery Act, which put a tourniquet on that hemorrhaging and allowed us to stop the bleeding and began to get things turned around. His policies of fighting for the middle class and working families, cutting taxes 18 different times for small businesses, making sure that we make investments in infrastructure and keeping teachers, firefighters, and first responders on the job. That's brought us to a point where we've now made 29 straight months of job growth in the private sector. President Obama's focus on making things in America so that we can make it in America and has caused us to have more jobs created in manufacturing than any time since the 1990s. So we've made progress. We've got a ways to go, but we need to keep moving forward. What we don't need to do, and I think the dramatic contrast that exists on the two paths and the two visions that have been laid out, is that Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan want to essentially drag us back to the failed policies of the past, trickle-down economics that has been tried and failed, that nearly crashed our economy, and that focuses on millionaires and billionaires and giving them more tax breaks, paid for by the middle class and working families. And that's certainly not the direction that we need to go. That's going backward, and that's not what Americans want to do.
Here is something that Paul Ryan said in his speech, appealing to unemployed people in their 20s.
College graduates should not have to live out their 20s in their childhood bedrooms, staring up at fading Obama posters and wondering when they can move out and get going with life.
What would you say to that same unemployed 28-year-old with a Shepherd Fairey Obama Hope poster on the wall?
What I would say to that young person is President Obama has made sure that when it comes to the lives of young Americans, that he's made their lives and improving their lives a priority. For example, by making a commitment to invest in education, particularly higher education, and increasing the amount of the Pell Grant available so that more, the thousands more young people can go to college, expanding the number of Pell Grants that were available, making sure that in the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, that young adults could stay on their parents' insurance until they're 26 years old. I've had moms stop me in the supermarket at home thanking me for President Obama's leadership on the Affordable Care Act because they were able to save thousands of dollars by putting their young adult children back on their insurance who'd lost their insurance under the old system. You're making sure that when it comes to a brighter future economically, that there are more job opportunities created because we've invested in small businesses and given them 18 different tax breaks so that they can hire again. So President Obama has made it possible for more young people to live the American dream, to make sure that if you work hard and play by the rules, that you can be successful. Well, and you contrast that with the Romney-Ryan plan, which actually cuts education, cuts college aid, cuts Head Start, essentially cuts the heart out of the future of the next generation and makes it more difficult for them to be successful and live the American dream.
With respect to the Affordable Care Act, which you mentioned, one of the biggest critiques is that it was the wrong thing to fight for at the wrong time, that we had an employment crisis and the president spent a year spending his political capital on a complicated health reform law that in addition has left employers more uncertain about the future. In retrospect, was that the wrong priority for the moment?
Well, President Obama rightfully prides himself on being able to walk and chew gum at the same time. And we don't have to deal with one important issue one at a time. While he was fighting for the middle class and working families, creating jobs and beginning to get this economy turned around and stopping the bleeding, we also made sure that insurance companies could not drop you or deny you coverage for pre-existing conditions any longer, that seniors would have that dreaded donut hole, the prescription drug coverage gap that thousands of them, the millions of them fall into and that caused them to have to choose between medicine and meals, that we'd close that donut hole and that coverage gap. Make sure that for breast cancer survivors like me, we wouldn't again have to be in a situation where when a doctor prescribes both radiation and chemo, that So many women have to choose one or the other because under the old system they couldn't afford both. That's what President Obama was able to do while ensuring that we lower health care costs and that we add 8 years of solvency for seniors in Medicare. So it was important because we did have a president who inherited the largest set of problems at once of any president since FDR. We needed to make sure that we had a president who was walking and chewing gum at the same time.
Last question, because I know you have to go. The Republicans say the Hope and Change president has not been running so much on the future as on making Romney seem unacceptable. Can you name the president's top three agenda priorities for a second term?
Well, I think Mitt Romney's done a good job all by himself making himself unacceptable by embracing extreme policies. But President Obama's plans for a second term are to make sure that we can invest in education, that we can continue to create jobs and get the economy turned around by adopting middle-class tax breaks, by doing things like taking away the incentive the corporations have from tax policy to ship jobs overseas and incentivize them instead to bring jobs back here in America so we can make things in America again, that we can continue to focus on giving everybody a fair shot and everybody a fair shake so that everybody can have a chance to be successful, not just the people that already are. And those are the policies that he'll embrace, like education and innovation and health care and making sure that we have a president in the White House who doesn't just focus on people who are already doing well, that we focus on people who just want an opportunity to live the American dream.
Democratic National Committee Chair and Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. Great to be with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with me now from the Democratic Convention, Lee Saunders, president of AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, which represents about 1.4 million public sector workers. Mr. Saunders, thanks very much for coming on, and welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Now, you represent everybody's local public employees, the teachers, police officers, firefighters, who the president's always talking about. But to many Americans, you are big government. With the unsustainable health and pension contracts that are pushing state and local taxes up so high and causing these deficits, what do you say to that perception?
Well, I say, first of all, that the way to resolve problems is not to steal our voices away from us and take collective bargaining away from us, and that's being discussed. That was discussed last week at the Republican National Convention. Scott Walker did just that in Wisconsin. John Kasich tried to do it in the state of Ohio. He was unsuccessful. We beat him back by a 2-1 margin. We know that we have problems and issues that confront all Americans in this country. The best way you resolve those problems in a labor management situation is to have a collective bargaining process. And that's what we push for. That's what we support. However, I would disagree with your premise. We have sacrificed. Public service workers have sacrificed. We provide essential public services to the public. We cannot be used and should not be used as a scapegoat for all of the ills and all of the bad things that are going on with the economy right now. We've fought many years, hard times to gain decent wages and decent benefits. And we will be happy to sit down and talk with anyone about how we can move this country forward, but we refuse to have those rights taken away from us.
Well, you say scapegoat, and I'll get back to your point about collective bargaining in a minute and ask you some questions from the other side. But is it just that public employees are being scapegoated? I mean, I often get calls from listeners who work in the private sector and say they don't get defined benefit pensions anymore. They have to make do with 401ks, and they don't get health benefits anymore without a substantial cost to themselves and premiums and deductibles and copays. So why should they pay extra tax dollars to give their employees, public employees, more expensive health and pension benefits than they can get in the private sector anymore? What would you say to those callers?
This is what I would say to that. I think that we are the richest country on the face of the earth, and we should not be participating in a rush to the bottom as far as wages and as far as benefits are concerned. The noise machine of the ultra-conservatives, the noise machine of the Republicans who spoke last week, their whole purpose is to divide and conquer in this country. They have been successful, quite honestly, in trying to divide public sector workers and private sector workers. They've been successful in dividing communities, and we can't let that happen. We are a country that country should be trying to provide decent wages, improve benefits for all. Not just the public sector workers, not just for private sector workers, but for all workers. That's the kind of country I believe that we want to live in. And I think that we've got to move forward rather than go backwards.
But is that kind of answer good enough for that private sector worker who feels he's paying more to your members than he's getting from his employer? In theory, it sounds nice, but, you know, to rise everybody up instead of make them have a race to the bottom. But are answers like that why Governor Scott Walker and Governor Chris Christie are winning elections?
I think that workers and working families across this country and the 99% of folks who are trying to play by the rules every single day are waking up. I think that they understand that the working families are under attack. Our very livelihoods are under attack, and we see that the top 1% in this country are gaining more wealth, gaining more power at the expense of the 99%, at the expense of working families. And I think that folks are making their voices heard in Ohio, in Wisconsin, in Florida, all across this country, and they're saying that's unfair. That there should be shared sacrifice, but that sacrifice should not take place on the backs of the 99% of workers who are trying to play by the rules every single day, put bread on the table, and send their kids to school.
Lee Saunders, president of AFSCME, with us, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Here's a clip of Chris Christie at the Republican convention where he seems to be talking directly to you and your members.
They said it was impossible to touch the third rail of politics, to take on the public sector unions, and to reform a pension and health benefit system that was headed to bankruptcy. But with bipartisan leadership, we saved taxpayers $132 billion over 30 years and saved retirees their pensions. We did it.
So do you acknowledge that many of the contracts that your member unions have had or do have become unsustainable for those local and county and state governments?
Well, this is what I would acknowledge, especially when you're dealing with New Jersey. For many, many years, to the present, New Jersey has not paid into the pension system. They chose not to pay into the pension system. Employees, state employees, pay into the pension system. Their money coming out of their wages every single day. The state chose not to. We believe that there's a contract with the state, and they chose not to pay. If, in fact, they aren't paying, then you're going to put that system in crisis. So the responsibility falls with Chris Christie and the governors before him. But that's that's what the kind of message that we've got to get out. The employer contribution is just a small percentage of the retirement benefit that comes to that employee. Most of the money is based upon the employee contribution and the investments that are made. The state of New Jersey, along with other states, have chosen not to continue to contribute to those plans, and that's put those plans in jeopardy.
But it's not most of the money comes from the employees, is it? Isn't it just a few percent in most cases come from the employees?
No, you misunderstood what I said. Most of the money comes from the employee contribution every single pay period, along with the investments that are made by the plan. The employer contribution is a very, very small percentage.
You're talking about the growth in the mutual funds or whatever the investments are.
Well, whatever the investments may be, yes.
Listeners, you can call in as we talk live from Charlotte with Lee Saunders, president of AFSCME, about the role of public employee unions in America today and in Democratic Party politics, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. AFSCME is one of the biggest political spenders in the country. Your bio says since 1990, AFSCME has donated more than $38 million to political campaigns, 98% of it going to Democrats. I read on Huffington Post that AFSCME is spending about $100 million this year to try and reelect President Obama. Is that number about right, per your understanding?
Well, the $100 million is not right. That is not just to reelect President Obama. We have a very active political organization, campaign where we not only invest in national politics for the presidential, for the House, for the Senate, but most of our money goes to support our friends at the state and local government level.
So that is about $100 million in all political campaigns.
It's budgeted for $100 million for all political campaigns. That's correct.
Why isn't that on its face a conflict of interest? That's why Scott Walker ended collective bargaining, according to him, and why some conservatives say public sector unions should not exist, even. Unlike in the private sector, you make political donations to get your bosses elected. So when they negotiate contracts with you, supposedly on behalf of the taxpayers, they're as beholden to you as to the taxpayers who are hiring them to be on the other side of the bargaining table. Is that not a conflict of interest?
I don't think so at all. Public service workers have the right to participate in the political process. Just as private sector workers have the right to participate in the political process, we at AFSCME have an independent voluntary PAC where people can pay into it or not pay into it. That's just a part of the democracy that we live in this country. So I don't see a conflict of interest at all.
What if the shoe was on the other foot? What if you're a union worker and your union negotiators were getting paid a lot of their salaries by management? Wouldn't that be a conflict of interest in their job of negotiating the best contract for you?
That's apples and oranges, and that has nothing to do with us participating in the political process. Clearly, we represent workers, and we sit across from management, and we negotiate contracts. And through the labor management process, hopefully we are successful in doing so. That's the labor management process, but that does not have anything to do with our participation in the political process. Again, I want to stress that public service workers, public employees should have the same and must have the same rights as private sector workers as far as being able to elect governors, being able to elect county commissioners, school districts, leaders, mayors, and presidents of the United States.
In retrospect, politically, was the attempted recall of Governor Walker a bad idea, trying to fight a policy difference through a recall election rather than wait until his reelection? That seemed to turn a lot of people off to your cause, even if they supported your cause, because recalls are for crime or corruption, not policy differences, no?
Well, we did find that. We did find that folks really were not excited about the recall process. They disagreed with what Governor Walker did in that state as far as taking collective bargaining away from public service workers in that state. The recall process was flawed in that people believe that not unless you're and polls show this, not unless you have done something, you know, as far as stealing money or something like that, then a lot of folks just think that you should be able to live out the term. If you look at Ohio, where we attacked it in a different kind of way, it wasn't through recall because you can't have a recall in that state under the state constitution, but we did have an initiative. We collected over 1 million signatures to put it on the ballot, collective bargaining on the ballot, and we won by a 2-1 margin. So we learned a lesson from that, but I will say this. Our members are still fighting in the state of Wisconsin. We're still working in coalition with many organizations across that state. We're continuing to mobilize and educate and organize our members, and they will be involved in this election in November.
And I gather you're hoping to do the same thing in Michigan that you did in Ohio, defend public employee collective bargaining rights through a referendum. Is that correct?
Well, no. You have a number of initiatives in Michigan right now. One is based upon the fact that the governor was successful in moving legislation through the state legislature, which provided him the ability to appoint someone in city government and county government and school districts to run those governmental jurisdictions and abrogate the contracts that have been negotiated by unions. We call it the dictator law. We were able to collect enough signatures in that state to put it on the ballot, and that'll be on the ballot in November, and we're organizing around that. We believe that elected officials have been elected. They shouldn't just be thrown out, with the bathwater and have the governor essentially appoint his own people to run those jurisdictions. We've also got an initiative, and we're working very closely with UAW, on making collective bargaining and organizing a constitutional right for the citizens of Michigan and for workers in that state.
My guest from the Democratic Convention is Lee Saunders, president of AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, 212-433-WNYC. Rob in Rego Park, you're on the air. Hi, Rob.
Right. How you doing, Guy? This gentleman talking is totally unrealistic. I'll be very specific. City of New York spends $8 billion sending pensions to retired workers, police and firemen, sanitation. My wife and I, we cannot contribute to paying these kind of pensions. The only place you could possibly get this money from is a 1%. Politicians refuse to do it. The future is 401k. This gentleman should wake up.
Rob, thank you. And I know from previous calls, Rob, in fact, if you're still there, I know from many of your other calls, you're a very liberal progressive caller on most things. Why do you think you depart on this issue?
I'll tell you why. Believe it or not, I'm a retired New York City fireman, but I only get $12,000 a year. Firemen these days get $5,000-$6,000 a year. So the past, they were able to afford it. But in reality is, the taxpayers can no longer pay this amount of money. Everyone's going to 401k, and that's going to be the future. You have to be pragmatic and realistic.
Rob, thank you very much. Well, a retired firefighter is taking that position.
We would hope that 401ks are not the future, number one. When you switch from a defined benefit program to a 401k program, it becomes much more expensive for the jurisdiction to do that. That's a fact. Secondly, if you looked at the market, if you would have been in a 401k, and some people were, when the market dropped, then they have no savings whatsoever. And that's those are the benefits behind keeping a defined benefit program. Again, it's about what kind of country we want to be. And if we're going to be continuing to move forward, or if we're going to be continuing to move, if we're going to move backward, our salaries and our retirement benefits for our retirees with an AFSCME average about $18,000-$19,000 a year. Very modest for a commitment to public service of 30 to 35 years. And we're going to continue to support and push for benefits and pensions that that provide a standard of living for retirees who have committed their livelihood to serve the public.
Ellen in Yonkers, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ellen.
Hello, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I feel that the teachers have really become a political football. I was never a teacher, but my husband was. And I think that today, probably our biggest crisis is making sure that our kids are going to be able to go on to school. And if we continue to make teachers like the villain in this play, they're not going to attract the caliber of teachers. My husband, for example, had a degree in organic chemistry and was an enthusiastic Mr. Wizard all of his teaching life. Today, people can go into much more lucrative positions than teaching. And I think that this sort of setting up the teacher as a straw man to attack just diverts from some of the real problems, like the political PAC contributions that are, I think, much more dangerous than any of the teachers' unions.
With the pressures, though, Ellen, on Yonkers City government, on Westchester County government, on New York State government, the pension funds, et cetera, do you feel it's not an issue that needs to be addressed? It's all a distraction?
I don't think it's a complete distraction. I think that we've had scandals in New York State about how some of the investments have been handled, but it was the politicians, not the teachers, that were doing the investing. I'm not against any kind of reasonable reconsideration, but I think the type of Chris Christie frontal attack is just feeding into his aspirations and not the country's.
Thank you very much, Ellen. I appreciate it. Before you go on, I think we have John Podesta from the Center for American Progress, President Clinton's former chief of staff, standing by next from Charlotte. The stimulus bill at the beginning of the president's term, Mr. Saunders, it was originally supposed to be about building a new green infrastructure. You remember shovel-ready projects to give the country something permanent for its $800 billion of new debt. But then much of it turned into bailing out states, counties, and municipalities. And the president still talks about Washington saving the jobs of teachers and firefighters and police officers is something he wants to do more of. Republicans say that's political payback because your union gives the Democrats so much money. Shouldn't we be suspicious of his priorities because of that financial connection?
Look, we have a jobs crisis in this country. We aren't creating enough jobs. The stimulus package created 3.3 million jobs in this country. And we should have more stimulus packages as far as I'm concerned. We've got to grow ourselves out of the economic crisis that we're just that exists right now. I think the president's jobs bill that was ignored by the House and John Boehner and folks like that, that would have helped.
Local governments.
That would have helped reduce the unemployment rate. It would have provided teachers and firefighters and cops, given them the ability to serve, increase those employment opportunities.
But what about
Those are very important occupations. But we've got to grow out of this crisis, and the way you grow out is to increase the number of jobs.
We've got 30 seconds left. What about when Wall Street firms spend $100 million on an election cycle? Are they not doing it expecting a payback, and should we see our union differently?
Again, we are participating in the political process, and you better believe that Wall Street has got a lot of money, and so do the Koch brothers, and we've got to be able to compete with that. We'll never be able to compete with all of the money that they spend, and that's why the Republican Party, that's why you hear Romney, that's why you hear Ryan, that's why you hear the conservative end of that party talk about decreasing the taxes for the top 1% while they are making millions and millions and billions, sometimes billions of dollars, and the 99% in this country suffer.
Lee Saunders, president of AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. John Podesta with us next. Brian Lehrer on WNYC and former White House Chief of Staff to President Clinton and founder and chair of the Center for American Progress think tank, John Podesta, joins us now from the Democratic Convention. Mr. Podesta, thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Yeah, it's good to be with you, Brian.
One of the prime arguments of the Republican Convention was that Democrats don't take the deficit and the debt seriously enough. Here is Congressman Ryan from his speech.
One president, one term, $5 trillion in new debt. He created a new bipartisan debt commission. They came back with an urgent report. He thanked them, sent them on their way, and then did exactly nothing.
So they have the Ryan budget, Mr. Podesta, but the President Commission then dismissed the Simpson-Bowles Commission without embracing them or offering an alternative. Is the Democratic Party serious about the debt crisis?
Absolutely, they're serious about the debt crisis, and I think that this is a kind of post-truth Republican Party now. I think that Congressman Ryan, vice presidential candidate Ryan, neglected to tell the audience that evening that he led the fight against Bowles Simpson, that he's put forward a budget that would exacerbate the deficit, wouldn't balance the budget even under the most optimistic circumstances till 2040. But I think that President Obama has a duty to explain to the American public where he wants to go with it. He didn't embrace the Bowles Simpson I rather wish that he had, but he didn't, because I think he disagreed with a few of them substantively. But he has put forward both tax proposals and spending proposals that would reduce overall spending going forward and raise additional revenue, particularly on those making the most in this country. So I think that he will have an opportunity to talk about his vision for economic progress on Thursday night. And I think part of that will be the fact that he wants to stabilize the debt and get it going down again the way Bill Clinton did in the 1990s.
When, then, can we expect to hear a full plan from the president that's as fleshed out? And I know the Ryan plan has a lot of vagueness in it and a lot of holes in it, but when will we hear a plan from the president, to your knowledge, that is at least as specific and detailed as the Ryan plan is?
Well, I think if you look at the president's budget, it's as detailed and specific as the Ryan budget, and it actually accomplishes more in the way of deficit reduction. But I think the real question, there's a big choice in this election between two really different economic philosophies, one in which you think you can just constantly cut taxes for the wealthiest Americans and good things will happen, another that says we got to invest in the middle class. We have to have a balanced program. We need to raise taxes on the very wealthiest Americans. And that's the way to get prosperity in this country. you know, for me, it's deja vu. It's Obama is pursuing a strategy that Bill Clinton pursued in the 1990s, led to three straight balanced budgets. It led to enormous wage growth and job growth for the middle class. Governor Romney is proposing policies that even go beyond what President Bush put forward in 2001 and 2003 that led to the great crash. So I think there's a big choice here.
Regarding President Clinton's years, and of course you were his chief of staff, and we had that boom, especially in the second half of his presidency. The Republicans were all over the Sunday talk shows this weekend saying, look, what really drove the economy through the roof in the late 90s was the tech bubble, the commercialization of the internet that was taking place then. And so the Clinton tax hikes weren't enough to stop that train, though they may have depressed growth a little bit. Do you see it differently?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that President Clinton in 1993 came in with an economic theory, put down an economic plan. It began to reduce the deficit. It put people back to work. It opened up opportunity for businesses to borrow. He invested in the innovation and technology. But most importantly, I think he focused on strengthening the supports for middle class Americans and working class people. He cut taxes on the working class. He raised taxes on the high end. It produced the greatest boom the country's seen since World War II. And I think that, you know, they want to explain this and that. You know, they've sort of, particularly in their convention this last week, they got sort of distant from the truth. But I think that we've seen what works. We've seen what doesn't. The trickle-down economics that were pursued subsequent to Bill Clinton led to the great deficits we saw coming into this new administration. We're still scrambling to deal with it.
But one of the other things under President Clinton's watch was the balancing of the federal budget, and along with the Gingrich Congress, the government at that time ran surpluses for the first time in many years. And President Obama came into office criticizing the Bush deficits, saying a $10 trillion accumulated debt was unacceptable, and then he added $1 trillion a year more on his watch. Can you defend that, the sheer amount of borrowing, in the context of his campaign promise and what's dangerous for our long-term fiscal health?
I think most economists would agree with this, that we were on the precipice of a Great Depression. He needed to stabilize the economy. We were hemorrhaging jobs at that point. 800,000 jobs a month were being lost. The demand was sinking like a stone in the ocean.
But there's still $1 trillion a year.
He had to come in and do something to stabilize that. Most of the loss of most of the reason that the deficit exploded was the result of the number of people who were out of work that occurred at the end of 2008, the beginning of 2009. It raised the amount we spent on unemployment benefits and on other supports for people who were out of work. It reduced the federal revenue, in part because people weren't working. But ultimately, I think most of the New York Times found that 60% of the deficit that was accumulated under President Obama's tenure was the result of the deep cuts in taxes that occurred for the wealthiest people that were put in place by the Bush administration. Now, President Obama extended those in 2010, so maybe, you know, you can't argue that he doesn't bear some of the burden of
that way. We've just got a
but
minute.
I think
we've got a minute left. I think that point is very clear. I appreciate it. Just on what you do these days, you launched the Center for American Progress, I think, to counter the money, power, and influence of the conservative think tank establishment that has grown up since just before the Reagan years. But do any of the think tanks think anymore, or are you on both sides just generating studies and papers to add some intellectual firepower to the dueling talking points?
No, we're very proud of what we've been able to accomplish. We began in 2003. I think we set the strategy in papers we wrote in 2005 and 2006 on how to exit Iraq, which then Senator Obama embraced and has executed as president. We've been trying to be a positive force in generating ideas for moving the country towards cleaner energy, towards expanded health coverage. And that has nothing to do with the bap of politics. It has to do with putting forward sound economic theory and sound ideas to improve the lives of middle-class Americans.
John Podesta, who is President Clinton's chief of staff and is now the chairman of the Center for American Progress think tank, thank you for giving us some convention time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.